So the title of the talk is Life is not a problem to be solved, but a mystery to be lived. It's a quotation, can't remember from whom. The Buddha, according to stories, texts, was walking in the village, and a villager saw him, and he was clearly a very impressive person to see. And the villager said to him, "Who are you? You look amazing. Are you a god? Are you a prince? Are you an angel?" He said, "No, I'm not a god, I'm not a prince, I'm not an angel, I simply woke up." That's a challenge to us, because it means basically that before he woke up he was asleep. The implication is that we are sleeping in life until we wake up. So, what does it mean, sleep? And clearly it doesn't mean some kind of anesthesia, hardama. It doesn't mean to be a vegetable. It doesn't mean laziness. It's something more than that. It's more like sleepwalking in life. That we live our life in a kind of a sleep, a dream, or a kind of automatic pilot, tayas automati. That's what he means by sleep. So in this talk, I want to go into much more detail about what it means, in a way, to be asleep. And it's an invitation of Yonatan yesterday to talk about the third of the three poisons, namely ignorance, or not seeing, or not awakening. So I'm going to talk about that, and then I'm going to talk about the process of awakening. I'm going to give another reading of the beautiful text that Reni brought the other day, a Buddhist poem actually, that really gives the sense of what it's like to be asleep. And I think that the original poem that she read, the English was rather old-fashioned, the translation from the Pali. So I reworked the English to make it more kind of user-friendly. So I'm going to read the same poem again, just to give the flavor of that sense of acting on automatic pilot. "Looking at people fighting, I experience dismay. Seeing people struggling like fish in small puddles, competing with each other. As I saw this, fear came into me. The world seemed pointless, without direction. I looked for peace, but found nowhere left, nowhere without conflict. I was upset. And then I saw an arrow here, so very hard to see, embedded in the heart. Overcome by this arrow, we run about chaotically, but pulling it out, we don't run about and we don't drown." And clearly the arrow, in a way, is something that is putting us to sleep or creating ignorance, and this sense of automatic pilot, this sense of just struggle, the sense of nowhere, meaninglessness, pointless, life being pointless without meaning. And he called it an arrow, but I think it's the arrow of ignorance. It's the arrow in the heart that stops us seeing. It's a little bit like being in the matrix. Like we live in a matrix. And by the way, I saw a wonderful, I don't know whether it still exists, on the internet, a very nice animation called Matrix. Does it still exist? Yeah? It's so good. and it's about a farm with lots of pigs. And two pigs woke up. And they said, "What is going on here? You don't realize, guys, that we're being held in this matrix and we're just being bred in order for the farmer to come soon and kill us and eat us. And you just sleep. You're just happily grunting away in your pen thinking everything's great, and you just wake up." And they didn't get that much reward. They got more grunts, I think, for their troubles. But our suffering comes from forgetting. Our suffering comes from being in the automatic world of struggle, conflict, and not finding peace. Our suffering comes from the arrow of ignorance. And the ignorance is a bit like the model of the cave, or the metaphor of the cave of Aplaton, in which the people are tied in a cave. They're tied down. And because they're tied down, all they can see is the shadows on the back of the cave. And they can't see the light, which is at the entrance to the cave, making all these shadows. So all of life passing by as kind of shadows, but not the source, the light itself. And so it's a powerful image, a powerful metaphor. And what we need to do is cut the chains. And the chains, another way of saying the arrow of ignorance. And the chains are chains of attachment. We are tied down. And because we are tied, we see the world as constructed, already built, nothing to do, just, as I say, automatic living, just doing our thing, functioning from birth to death. And the attachment does it. And the attachment is the second noble truth, and it's the source of suffering. It's the chains that tie us to this ignorance. Oh, it is the ignorance. So we need to look at attachment a little bit to understand more deeply. The word attachment in the Pali is upadana. And upadana has two meanings. One is bemet, chains, to be tied, to be attached, to be stuck. But another meaning is feeding, is what it is that we feed in our life. And this feeding can go in different directions, but the feeding is feeding of more of the same. Just we keep feeding the same constructions, the same thoughts, the same patterns, the same buildings in our consciousness and in the world, the same kind of me and the world. So feeding is it's a more dynamic image. Attachment is a little bit too much like chains, but feeding is dynamic. So I quite like that, because we can feed the opposite. We can feed freedom, or we can feed attachment or closure. So there's four kinds of attachment according to the tradition. The first is attachment to the senses, kama. That means everything that we like, we want, we need, everything. What it is you want, what you feel you should have, things you like and don't like, possessions, other people you like or don't like, tastes, a new car. I really want a new car. You should see my car. It's 20 years old. But my wife refuses. She's attached to the old car. I'm attached to the new one. But it goes into all kinds of places. It goes into, you know, very simple things in life, like we might be attached to switching off. Oh, well, at the end of the day, I watch the TV. Again and again and again every night and again and again. Instead of what? I want to run away from all this crazy life, so watch the TV. Just simple things in life like that, they are attachments. And we know attachments to the mind that we've all experiencing here, attachments to the pleasantness of speculations, planning the future, being somewhere else, imagining ourselves having a cup of coffee in Tel Aviv instead of all this sweat here. All this, the mind giving us lots of temptations, joy, writing whole books in the mind. This is pleasure. This is the sensations of pleasure that we get stuck with. The second one is ditti, which is views. Views and opinions. But it goes very deep also. It's views about everything. Views about life. Views about who we are. Views, we talked a lot in this retreat about the conflict, the war, which is views about the other. They are enemies. They are going to do bad things. They are against us. We are the victims. Views. They're views. They're not checked out as being absolute truths. They are held as views, and then automatically they become truths. Almost every thought we think is a view of the world, hashkafat olam, and we don't know it's a view, we think it's reality. One that has come up in this retreat, one view is judging others or ourselves to be more or less. It's a view. I am bigger, I am smaller than. Or someone else is better than. I am succeeding, not succeeding, failing. It's a view. The third attachment is attachment to what needs to be done. Sila. What is right? What is religious? What is, like, if I kiss the mezuzah, it will stop something bad happening to me. It's an attachment to an action in the name of a religious action. But attachment to behaviors, we get it in Buddhism a lot. The monks can get very attached to a way of doing things, and it becomes holy and absolute, We can get attached here that the retreat has to be like this. I taught a retreat on non-dual, on non-self, and one day we went into the hall and everything had turned round. The teachers were at the back, my seat was at the back, and everybody was sitting opposite. And it was such a nice, refreshing change. And you realized how much you're attached. Now we're attached. We're attached to our seat. We're attached to the teacher being here. We're attached to a teacher. We're attached to a form. It happened very quickly. If the whole thing had sort of shifted dramatically after a day or two, how many takim there would be on the board. What's happening? Why? So it happens very easily. Attachment to a way of doing things that says this is right and this is, and something else is not right. That's sila. And the fourth is the big one. It's attachment to me and mine. Self. Atta. And everything around that. And it goes very deep also. Who I am is a construction. I assume so much. Each one of us says, well, I'm obviously me. And what does that me mean? I have a name, I'm an Israeli, I've got this body, I've got this personality, I've got these parents, I've got this world, it's me, and I react from this subject. But that's attachment. In the deepest sense, if we try and really find this me, hard to find. It's an attachment to something that is created as a result of conditioning called me. And it goes out into mine, my house, my family, my people, my group, my car, my possessions, my way of doing things, my choices, etc. I was once a very lovely model of ignorance. I was once in a park in London, and there were squirrels. You know a squirrel? It's Naeem. And there was an old man in the park, St. James's Park, near Buckingham Palace, and he was feeding nuts to the squirrel. Well, the squirrel couldn't eat all the nuts he was giving him. So the squirrel took a nut, made a little hole, and buried it. And then took another one, walked two steps, made another hole in the earth, and buried it. And then another two steps, made another hole, and buried it. And this went on. The squirrel was going along like that, burying his nuts. What the squirrel didn't know was behind was a black bird. And the black bird was digging up every nut and eating it on the spot. And the squirrel had no idea that behind it was this black bird digging up every single nut. Had no idea. To me, this is a beautiful model of ignorance that I can't imagine a model more clear. Well, we are like that squirrel. We have no idea, you know, of what's behind us, kind of changing everything, making everything just. So we keep building our world based on attachment. And we build our world based on the model that was. The tichnun, the blueprint, the plan of yesterday becomes the reality of today. And we build constructions, sankharas. And we don't know we do it. And then once we build these sankharas, these habits, these ways of thinking, these thoughts, these possessions, these sense of self, just all the things I mentioned, once we build them, we live inside them. And that's where the prison is for us. And that's the arrow in the Buddha's image. And that's the sense of suffering that we have, where we feel we're living in a kind of box, like a kind of ogier, a hamster that's going around in the wheel, and that's a little bit like our life. And that's the suffering, and that's the ignorance, the poison of ignorance. It keeps the whole wheel of samsara going around and around and around and around, of birth and death. It's a very powerful understanding, it's a fundamental understanding of the Dharma. So when the Buddha awakened, what he said was very interesting. He said, I have broken the roof of the building. This building will never ever be built again. I've broken the roof beams. Actually, he said roof beams, korot gag. This building will not be built again. And it's also a powerful image, because what it means is that he's broken the construction of sankhara. He's broken the box. He's burst the box. He's out of the box. And it points to deconstruction as a way out rather than construction. And deconstruction as wisdom, as a sense of a bigger reality which is available to us out of the box. So I want to talk about this now, what that may mean for us. Where is the wisdom? How is the wisdom? And how we work with the materials of life to get out of the box, to break the construction, the korot gag. One of the images that came to mind while I was thinking about this afternoon was the retreats that we've been running for cancer patients. And this is a really powerful image, because it's a huge challenge. A doctor tells you, you have cancer. It takes one moment for that message to arrive. It creates a radical, radical change in your life. It's just a message, actually. But what happens then is that everything changes. Your view of yourself, your view of your life, your view of what you need, what you don't need. It changes your joy, mostly to suffering. You develop a personality called a victim. You develop an attitude of struggle and fighting. Huge amount of struggle against the system, the medical system, the doctors, the world around. It recruits other people, it makes a big story around it. Well, that's the message. From a message called you have cancer, there is this whole chain of construction or conditioning. But in our retreats with cancer patients, it was utterly amazing to watch how in one weekend all kinds of other possible narratives or stories began to emerge. Like, grouped together, there was so much laughter, and there was a lot of laughter and joy appearing in the middle, and relief appearing in the middle of the retreat. And sometimes, you know, I would go there and we'd talk together in the groups, and they would be saying, oh, we're laughing at the stupid doctors. Oh, we're laughing at how they don't understand us. Or we're laughing at what other people do around the issue of cancer in the society, how their people don't are so afraid of it. Something changed in the weekend, in just a short weekend. Something changed. We were working on love, a lot of heart. We were working on support. We were working on inner freedom, meditation, and it wasn't so difficult to change the energy completely of this narrative. And to me it's a very strong image from closure inside a story called I Have Cancer to opening a reality which is, of course, my life is full and I'm here and I have many experiences and life is open and free. And yes, there is cancer. But it's not, doesn't need to control every minute of my life. So attachments or ignorance making things solid and closed, the wisdom comes through seeing that the nature of life is open and free. The minute we open our eyes and say, who am I really? Then this story called I'm a cancer patient drops away because it's not true. It's true there is a disease, but it's not true all the implications around it. That I have this and I'm a victim and I must suffer and I must struggle and I must this and that my life is ruined and it's the end of my life. And all of these stories, they're not true. They are fictions, they are thoughts that take a solid, we believe in them. But the reality is, a beautiful cup of tea in the morning overlooking the Carmel where we had our workshop, and people were sitting outside having tea and just watching the view. Where's cancer? Don't know. At that minute, you have to remind them that there's cancer. So they see the difference, the seeing that we are much more than our box is what helps us emerge out of the ignorance, out of the conditioning. Another example, also another retreat that we did recently in Kleel, we had a retreat with Germans and Israelis, and around the issue of memory, and particularly the memory of the Holocaust. And it's again one of these things. You take the Holocaust and it kind of sits in the consciousness as a construction, taking space. And the more you don't see it, the more space it takes. Because it works. It makes us anxious. It makes us feel, again, victims. It makes us contracted, takes away some joy, and maybe the whole country is in that place because of a narrative called the Holocaust, which is sort of in the unconscious, subconscious, just sitting there doing things and having implications, hashlachot, and the Germans having the same, but a different version of the same story. The guilt, and we don't know what happened, and I don't know what my grandfather did in the war, and we never talk about it in the family, and we're all feeling something terrible in the background, but we can't deal with it. They have the same. But in the process, during the retreat, of just allowing these voices to come and be seen and be touched, they become flexible, they become real, and they become less powerful, dominant constructions. They become alive. Yeah, what's the guilt? Let's have a look at it. What's the victim mind? Let's have a look at it. Oh, it's this. Okay, it's that. Instead of the elephant in the room, Pil Becheda, that everyone is not touching, and the room gets very small because you're all avoiding the elephant. So you say, "Ah, there's an elephant. Okay, what's he like? He's got skin like this and a trunk like that, and then there's the room. Lots of freedom." So I want to talk specifically about two areas that we're working on here as examples. And the first area is the area of thought. And I want to talk a little bit about thought. The way we work with thought in the retreat in the Dharma is basically allowing it to be what it is, not suppressing, not stopping it, not encouraging thinking, allowing thought to be seen as thought. It is possible to shift thinking, to rewrite the scripts. I would say this is the sograim in brackets, that it's quite okay if there's a very difficult thought to say, I do want to stop it or move it to something else or give kindness to it and change the energy inside. So it doesn't mean that we shouldn't work with thought. But the basic practice is actually deeper than that. It's looking straight at thought as thought. It's seeing a story as story. As Yonatan was giving instructions this morning on noting. Noting a thought as a thought like this. Thought about the future. Thought about the past. Thought about planning. If we keep doing this for some time, and we do need patience, because thought is very powerful, because we gave thought a lot of power. Thought is just energy, but we gave it power through identification. We make a thought is us. We gave it power. So it feels very powerful, and we feel overwhelmed by thought sometimes. But nevertheless, thought is just a story floating by. That's all it is. And the closer we look at thought, the more it becomes something invisible, like a cloud in the sky. The more we look at thought, the less solid it becomes. A story that is really bugging us again and again. When we look at them, look at it carefully, it's made of nothing. We gave it power, but it's made of nothing. Just a little bit of energy, electricity, hafrashot in the mind. Secretions in the mind. It's a very important insight, because when we look carefully at reality, we actually don't need to do anything with it. We don't need to get rid of anything. We don't need to stop anything. We just need to see that it passes by itself. And this is a huge, huge insight of the Dharma. Everything has a sell-by date. Pag toke. Everything. Everything has a beginning and an end. We don't need to get rid of stuff because it goes by itself. We just need to see clearly that the whole field of mind, body, spirit, and the world is moving, is dynamic. So we can relax and not try and get rid of or struggle against anything, because it passes, it goes, it changes. The Buddha described it as a line on water, writing a line on water. And there's another important aspect, which is as we watch thought. We are developing the capacity to be a witness of thought. The witness is consciousness, awareness. In awareness, there's no problem. Awareness is just awareness. It is out of the construction business. The thought is a construction. The awareness that sees thought is out of the construction. We all did it here. Sometimes people say, I have so much thinking. How do you know you have so much thinking? Because there's some part of you, which is not thinking, that says, I see thinking. That part of you which is not thinking is like the ocean and the wave. The wave is a thought. It's made of the same stuff as the ocean, namely awareness. But there's the ocean and the wave. The wave is known by the ocean. The wave goes back into the ocean. As much as we can be in contact with thought as it arises and it goes, and if we get more close to thought, we can see that it's coming out of the ocean and going back into the ocean, and it's made of water, and water is pure awareness, and in this water is no problem. The problem are in the ignorance, in the construction, not in the awareness itself that just is knowing, which is timeless and endless. So working with basically undoing ignorance, namely the packaging, we naturally create wisdom, which is like the ocean. Awareness that has no problem is wisdom. We experience it. And many of you are experiencing it as being more in the moment, being more spontaneous, being more free, having a sense of a bigger space with which we connect with the world. And it simply comes from getting out of the constructions or taking them less seriously, believing in them less, and instead being aware and awake of what's really happening. So when every time we do this, for example with thought, coming out of the construction, something opens. And we experience it as more living with more space, living more freely, living with more lightness. That's how we experience that. I'd like to read a few words from Wordsworth, the poet. I have felt a presence that disturbs me with the joy of elevated thoughts, a sense sublime of something far more deeply interfused, meaning merged together, whose dwelling, whose place, is the light of setting suns, and the round ocean, and the living air, and the blue sky, and in the mind of man, a motion and a spirit that impels, that drives, all thinking things, all objects of thought, and rolls through all things. Pointing to when we understand what is behind or what is in the nature of thought, we see it becomes connected to the setting suns and something inside the reality of the universe. It connects us with the universe. It becomes part of the messages of the blue sky and the round ocean and the living air. and something that drives all life. And briefly, kind of using up my time, but briefly I want to talk about emotion as another area of inner work, where we can undo the constructions. And indeed, emotion gives us huge problems and suffering. And all the time, life presses our buttons. We feel life is pressing our buttons constantly, every day. And of course, emotions are about protection. Anger is about protection. Anger is about defense. Anxiety is about worry, and worry is about safety, the future, what's happening out there. So a lot of emotional life is about protection. But emotions are habits. We respond emotionally through habit of way of responding to the world. And the way to work with emotions is basically not to stop them, not to suppress them, and not to encourage them. And there's a big space in between. I think, well, so what if I don't suppress them and I don't express them, so what's left? Actually, there's a big space in between. And that's being with emotional life. Being a partner with emotional life. Stay with them, but let them dissolve naturally. Let them just dissolve, and they do. Emotions are like water. They also have a sell-by date. They will not stay forever. They come and they go when they want. Life does it. Emotional response, and emotion comes and goes. Sometimes it's helpful, because emotions are very strong. If some of you are having quite powerful emotional experiences here, it's sometimes helpful to take a place in the emotional response, one spot, and work just with that. And I want to tell you a story about my own practice with emotion. A long time ago, I used to be a lecturer in University of London, in the medical field, and I had this disastrous fear of talking in front of people. It was just hell. Pahad kahal. I wanted to die. The students came into the hall, and you know, the lecturers are down, and the students all up in rows like that. And they came in, and they came in, and I wanted just to go into the smallest possible place. I wanted the earth to open, and that I could fall in. I wanted to die. It was horrible. And then when I start to talk, oh, my mouth was dry, and I was scared, and I didn't know what to say, and everything, you know, magamgen, and my heart beating, and the tummy contracted, and it was a terrible experience. But I was practicing Dharma at that time, and I decided to take one spot, and that would be the whole of the emotion, and the spot was the stomach. And I decided that every time I felt the fear, I would look at the contraction in the stomach as a window of the fear, and just that. And it was as if, you know, you have a program in the computer and the whole screen, and you press a button and it minimizes into a little icon. It's exactly what happened. The whole fear minimized itself, whoop, into a small contraction in the tummy. And I was with that. every time. And that eventually went as well. So it's kind of finding a place where the fear was a simple phenomena, tofa'a. It wasn't more than a phenomena, which it really is. It's just a phenomena. We build it so much because it's us, and it's got thought in it, it's got biology, it's got hormones, it's got heart, it's got memory, it's got physiology, it's got other people in and images. It's huge emotion, and that's why it's difficult for us to work with it. But if we collapse it into something just a phenomena, and in my case the stomach, that's all. And it went. It took a year or two. It needed some patience because it's very strong emotion. But it went. Just gone. So, like everything, like with thought, that it leads us to a bigger space. When ignorance is dealt with or reduced, then wisdom arises very often by itself. And I mentioned with thought how when we're not stuck on just seeing the wave, we have a possibility of seeing the ocean. And the same with emotion. If the emotional life doesn't control us and is not such a heavy construction on us, like anxiety that is just holding us in prison, actually it opens to a huge music of the heart, which is constantly making music in us. Because we are not a computer, we're alive. And the life brings feelings with every experience. And so once we are in touch with, we are in relationship with emotional life, instead of being imprisoned by it, it becomes a dance inside us, and we feel it, emotional life flowing freely. So again, liberation comes from getting out of the box. It's not just that we have a problem we have to deal with. It's when we deal with the problem, it opens us to freedom and to a bigger world. I want to quote Etty Hillerson here because she's a great inspiration the way she writes, and she writes just about this point. She was, some of you may know her book. She was writing at the time of the Nazi control of Holland, and she was a Jew in Amsterdam, and she was writing a diary as the Gestapo were out in the streets and as all her friends were killed or sent off to concentration camp. And in the end she herself was sent to a concentration camp, but she managed to throw out a postcard from the truck, from the rail truck, which said, "I am going singing." And her diary is so beautiful because in the midst of the most terrible difficulty and pain for her and her community, she experienced huge awakening. She writes, "Does that mean I am never sad, that I never rebel, I always agree, and love life no matter what the circumstances? No, far from it. I believe that I know and share the many sorrows and sad circumstances that a human being can experience. But I do not cling to them. I do not prolong," meaning extend, "such moments of agony. They pass through me like life itself. as a broad, eternal stream. They become part of that stream, and life continues. If you have given sorrow the space its gentle origins demand, then you may truly say, life is beautiful and so rich. So I want to just finish with small comment on when we kind of break open ignorance and wisdom arises and a sense of freedom which is behind the constructions which we make and which we control us. Some of the signs of this bigger space that open up, and it's useful to know them because they're not some, we don't have to wait to be the Buddha this life or many future lives. It's now. We're all little Buddhas right now. And some of the ways in which we can recognize places of inner freedom, or we may not notice because we jump over them to the difficulty. And that's where the title of the talk, life is not a problem to be solved, but a mystery to be lived. So some of the signs I just want to suggest, and you can look out for them in the practice here or in the practice in your life. One I already mentioned, with the sense of spaciousness, the sense of openness that arises when we're out of the box. It's a feeling of openness, a feeling of having expanded boundaries, that we're not locked in my thought, my this, my needs, my this, I have to, I don't have to, I no. We actually can feel the openness in our experience. Our mind is more open. It's sense of openness. Another sense is time. Time takes on a bit of a different, and we can feel a little more timeless, a little more like, yeah, I don't know, why do we have a bell ringer? Because there's a sense of time, the retreat begins to take on timelessness. And we need a bell ringer to tell us to go here and go there. But there is something really in the nature of a certain freedom which says, spontaneous, the moment is just the moment. It doesn't have a clock. It's just the moment by moment experience. It goes with a quality of rishoniyut, the immediacy, every moment is a new moment. Miyadiyut, it's now, living in the now. That's a quality of that goes with coming out of the box, coming out of the ignorance. This sense of living in the now, just now. Just now. Now. Another quality that we might feel or experience here is a quality of partnership. Shutaf, partnership. To be with. To be with the trees, to be with the ants in the path, to be with each other. But we don't talk to each other here. But gradually there's a closeness developing between us. We just feel the presence of the person next to us. We just feel that we're together. It doesn't need words. The words actually just disturb. This sense of partnership is a sign of being out of the box. And finally, what's really hard to describe in language is a quality of, in English you would say isness. Kahut is the word that's used, I've heard used, but it's maybe not a good word, or we invented it in the Dharma community, or somebody invented it. I think Yaakov Raz invented it as a, but it's very much, it comes from the Sanskrit and Pali of tat, which is similar to the English that, and it's the name of the Buddha, Tathagata, means that, there, beyond, or so it's just the quality of here we are, this is it, and things are as they are. And it's not exactly acceptance, it's deeper than that. Because acceptance is a kind of, oh, I have to accept, it's kind of a control, I have to accept. It's not that. It's an understanding or a deep experience of this is it, here it is, this is it, which is going through every moment. And it brings ease and quiet and no struggle. Thank you.